The giant sandworms and Timothy Chalamet's brooding face are back. I can't promise you that we'll be praising Dune Part 2 as much as the rest of the internet, but what I can at least promise, as unintentional as it might have been, we won't crack a single joke about the popcorn bucket. Welcome everyone to the Atomic Cinema Experiment. I am Peter, and joining me as always is David.
I come in peace.
This is a science fiction movie podcast. We watch a sci-fi movie, we talk about it, it's that simple. And we have a new release today. It's actually our kind of our first big new release of the year, I think, on Ace.
Yeah, I'd say so.
So, yeah, we're here today to talk about Dune Part 2. So, you know, we'll get into it. We'll start spoiler-free, of course, as we always do. Although it is a Part 2, so even in the spoiler-free, there could be some spoilers for Part 1, just kind of naturally. So be aware of that.
Spoiler alert, there's a lot of sand.
Before we get into it, though, I'll just remind you that if you are enjoying the show on YouTube, please do hit the like button. It helps us out a bunch. And you can, of course, get bonus shows from me and David over on Patreon. I'll tell you more about them at the end. And also, David does homework at the end where he watched a movie that me and Tara did long ago on NAS, so you can catch up.
So I got to get smart.
Yeah, so that's everything that's coming up on the show. But we'll dive in to Dune in Part 2. We'll go in depth, as we do. Let's just, you know, let's get the balls on the table.
All right.
Right?
Yep.
My thoughts on Dune Part 1 were lukewarm. I was not that enthusiastic about it.
I don't
remember how you felt about Dune Part 1.
Because I did not see Dune Part 1 when it came out, I only watched it as first time on the homework. I kind of missed all the hype on that. So once I got to it, I think I was closer to lukewarm than overly hyped. I did like it, I think, more than you did. But I did think that pacing, especially towards the end, was a problem. I was feeling the length of the movie by that, like, last 45 minutes, and it just took me out of it. The fact that I couldn't enjoy the end of the movie on, like, a high, you know?
Hmm. Well, you'll be pleased to know this one's longer.
Yeah, great, fantastic.
It was definitely this like, it was bearing down on me as I noticed the runtime when I was booking my ticket, and I'm like, 2 hours and 47 minutes, you say? Okay, I'll brace myself for that, shall I
specifically went in, I picked like an afternoon showing, and I was like, all right, and I'm talking to my girlfriend, I'm like, all right, I'm gonna head out now. I hopefully will be back before it's dark, but I make no guarantees.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny though, because I was lukewarm on Dune Part 1, and I'm sure I'll bring up many of those reasons as we're talking about Dune Part 2, but I remember thinking that possibly it may just be because it is literally half of the first book, and all of the climactic stuff, all of the things that we're actually building to aren't going to happen until the second part. Maybe I felt frustrated by that. Maybe the fact that I know the original movie by David Lynch, and because that did the whole story in one, because the way that story was paced in that movie, which was too crammed in, don't get me wrong, it tended to be like the second movie of this version was like the third act to that movie, so that was like the really condensed part. So the first movie, part one of this new version of Dune, felt like most of that original movie just kind of stretched out for a longer runtime. And I get that there's obviously things that are objectively better about it, but I think that might have also hindered like how much I was getting into it. That said, though, I think I've diagnosed a few things based on Dune Part 2, which I'll get into later, which we can talk about as we go in. But yeah, I mean, honestly, usually I'll do like a brief synopsis. It feels weird for this, though, because it just sort of picks up from the cliffhanger of Part 1.
Yeah.
You know?
It's Paul is spending his time with the Fremen.
Yes.
And oh boy, does he get into some hijinks.
And the Harkonnens are in power on Arrakis, and that's what's happening. So we'll get
introduced to Christopher Walken.
We get introduced to Christopher Walken, yes. I have thoughts on him too. So I'll just ask the question. David, what did you think of Dune Part 2?
I'm such a mark for big theater experiences. Like, it always gets me, and I always come out of it thinking the movie is better than it is. So I really have to sit and, like, think on it and think critically about it, which I get is my job here, but still. I think it's better than the first one. I think I enjoyed it more than the first one because it does finally kind of crescendo on a bunch of these things that the first movie felt like it was also building to, but obviously we never got the climax for. I will say that I really enjoyed the themes it was playing with. I really enjoyed the expansion on some of the characters, but like, once again, I think about 45 minutes to the end, 30 minutes to the end, somewhere in that, I just kept expecting it to cut to black. I kept expecting it, like, and then next time, but like, it just kept going. And I, again, it's a pacing issue. I think these movies just go a little bit too long for me. And I get that these books are very dense and they're already still cutting stuff out, but like, it's just, there's a bit too much and it just can't hold my attention that long.
And this is still the first book, I believe.
Like, yeah.
I think this does more or less take you up to the end of the first book. And I'm saying that having not read it. I'm basing that on kind of where the original movie ended and the fact that this, well, does kind of end with a setup for what's next. I think the next movie would be based on the next book.
Right.
I could be wrong, though. So do the experts, by all means, correct that in the comments if you...
Oh,
if
they
you,
will. You will. Everything we get wrong, they will.
Joe is so wild. My experience watching this was like, okay, I sat down, I went in with the best of, not expectations, because like I say, I was lukewarm in the first, but with the best intentions of like, okay, I really want to like this, and I've always wanted to like Dune.
Yeah.
And I, you know, the movie starts, it picks up where the last one left off, it's going along, and I think there are moments, and there's definitely some characters that I like more than the first movie, for sure. Mm-hmm. But as it was sort of going into its back half and it was getting to a lot of its third act stuff in this film, I was really, once again, feeling this disconnect with being able to actually really feel invested in anything going on. And I think a big problem for me in this one in particular is just not in any way connecting or empathizing with the main character at all and really struggling with that throughout. Okay. And to be honest, a lot of the characters, I actually think Zendaya's character is probably the one that I empathize with the most. She's the one that felt the most human to me. Mm-hmm. And that's nice. What's funny about that is I've actually heard that they expanded that character a lot from the book, and the book she's kind of underwritten. So it's kind of funny that I ended up liking her the most out of all the characters in this.
That's the thing. I was thinking back to the 84 Dune. I was thinking back to her character. I'm like, wow. Either 84 Dune did nothing with it, or this movie expanded so much more on the book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of stuff that was missing in that movie just because they had to cut it down into a two-hour movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, part one of this was longer than that movie, never mind the whole thing. Because, I mean, you put them together, you've got over 5 hours of a story here that we've told. I think my big thing is like I like some of the themes it's playing with, and I appreciate the ideas that it's playing with of manipulating a population with the idea of like spreading a new religion or a prophecy to control them. And that's something when they're talking about those kind of things from that context, and Zendaya's character Chani's being critical of it and sort of saying, hey, this is all just to control people and things like that, I enjoy when it's looking at it through that lens. But I feel like large stretches of the movie still just kind of turn into Paul's motivation for doing certain things is nothing more than a magic dream or a magic drink towards the third act of this movie, when he's making some big plays where he's really changing as a character, I never felt like there was a good human motivation for why he was finally giving in to anything. It just felt like now's the time he's doing it because a magic dream told him to.
Yeah. I think a big problem I also had with Paul's character is that there is this idea of, like you said, manipulating the people with this prophecy. But we, as the audience, never really get the full prophecy. Like, people just kind of spout off certain bits. And then whenever Paul does something, they're like, as it was written. And it's like, where? You've never mentioned that this has ever been part of the prophecy before now. I feel like Paul could just say, like, oh, by the way, I'm left-handed. And everyone would be like, oh, as it is written, he's left-handed.
Yeah, and likewise, I think Paul's mother, Jessica, I think she, her character, like, because she's so tied to all this prophecy crap, I just get really frustrated when I was watching, particularly as the movie went on and it was getting into...
I don't know. I feel like her character, it got so weird by the end that it almost crossed over into like a different kind of enjoyment for me. It was more so of like what I expect, like kind of what I would have expected from Dune 84, of it's just not explaining anything and it's weird in that sure. way, but it's almost enjoyable to that extent.
I think if more of the movie was like that, I might, because I kind of like the 84 version of Dune as kind of like just a train wreck of like ideas that are never really clicking together or explained. It's not a great movie by any means, but I think with this movie though, I think I'm expected to really care and be invested in everything. I'm, you know, it's giving time to a lot of characters, but somehow I feel like I never really truly connect with most of them. Zendaya's character Chani is the only one who was barely in the first part, right? You know, she was only get introduced right at the end of it. Yeah. Here I feel like she was the one actually speaking some kind of sense that I could relate to, that I could understand. It felt like a good voice for the audience to kind of latch on to. But maybe one of the other problems with the movie is that, you know, a big part of the story here is a romance between her character and Paul. It wasn't the worst romance in the world, but I also didn't really feel that much from it either. Like you know, the first moments where like he's staring at her longingly and like he's almost zones out of what she's actually saying because he's too enchanted by her beautiful face, and the music sort of ramping up, and all I could think was, oh, this is how we're starting this romance, is he's just caught off guard with her beauty in a moment. It felt weak to me.
I agree, but not in the way that you were saying it. I think that him falling for her makes sense because of all the magic dream stuff. Like, he believes it is his fate to be with her, and so he's just automatically smitten. I think the reverse side needed more time. I didn't get why Chani is all of a sudden like, actually, okay, yeah, no, I'm into you.
There's a great point there, actually, comes out of that, is that she, at one point, when she's talking to another Fremen, says, oh, he's not like the other outsiders or the other strangers. He's, what was the word she used?
Sincere.
Sincere, that was it. I was going to say genuine, but sincere is the exact word she used. And I was like, okay, that's great. You're telling me that, but I don't think I felt that from this character at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Especially because I think like just before that conversation, we have Paul talking to his mother saying like, we need to manipulate these people and we need to do this stuff like using religion. I'm like, he's clearly not sincere.
Yeah. Plus I went back and forth. You were just saying there that, you know, he by his side of the romance because he believes in the fate of these dreams and all that. And honestly, for the first half of the movie, I actually couldn't decide if he did believe in any of it or if he did just think it was a bunch of klabooey. I genuinely didn't know.
And that's kind of what I like about it, though, in terms of his plot, because I don't relate to him. I don't see, like, his side of things, but I don't think that I really need to, because I think he's supposed to be playing, like, a more secretive character. These plans within plans that they keep talking about, where his whole thing is that he's saying straight up, like, we need to be able to manipulate these people into believing that I'm the Messiah. But then he comes back and does the whole like, oh, no, I'm not the Messiah. I'm not the chosen one here. So I think that all in all, it is just one big con on his part. It is one big thing of him basically trying to manipulate himself into a place of power, which doesn't make it relatable. It makes him almost antagonistic in a way, but like, It's an interesting through line for a character for me.
Yeah, but I think that's my problem, though, is that I didn't even feel like I got an arc where I understood why he changed his mind and now that's wanted true. Power. Like, even that part of it didn't work for me. Like, I didn't empathize with him, and I didn't really in the last movie either, because let's face it, he starts out as this prince, right? He's like, I feel like this character maybe need to not necessarily be more down to earth, but be like maybe something, to compare it to the 84 movie again. Kelly MacLachlan does kind of have this smiling earnestness to him, whereas Timothy Chalamet is such a, I'm a dramatic actor and I'm going to stare off into the distance. It's impossible for him to make the character likable. He can do drama, but he can't necessarily do the drawing you in with the charm. That's just not really who he is.
He has brood. He doesn't have charm. Yeah. There's a difference.
So I felt so disconnected, and by the time all the big third act spectacle stuff was happening, there were some fantastic shots in the middle of all of it. Absolutely. No one's going to take that away from it.
No.
I felt like I just didn't care. I think by the end of the movie, I went through a bit of a roller coaster where I was seeing things, okay, maybe I can get into this one more because it's sort of starting to sort of touch on these ideas. But by the time it went so head first into all the prophecy stuff and Paul's like journey and how stilted that felt to me, by the time I got to the end, I was like, you know what? I like, this has only just solidified how lukewarm I feel about this pair of movies now. And it's left me not that excited for a part three.
Honestly, I think I can stand this one on its own. I can really enjoy this one because it does have such a focus on Chani, and that being the human element. I really like her arc in this, and specifically how it relates to Paul. But I think that that almost weakens the experience of both of them concurrently, because she does not have any sort of role in the first one. Like, if I were able to view these movies and say, like, oh, okay, it's Paul and Chani's story, I'd be like, great, cool, awesome, I'll take it as such. But because the first movie is so just Paul, it's, I don't think that watching these two consecutively is going to draw me into Paul's character anymore. It's just going to be like, why isn't Chani here earlier?
Yeah, and also, I wonder if, like, it may also maybe hurts this one that Chani doesn't really have much of an impact on the actual story. Like, she always has an impact on Paul. She's there for Paul. She talks to Paul and helps motivate him or comfort him and whatever, and she reacts to things that Paul does. But she never really has any agency as far as actually affecting the overall plot. And it makes sense that she doesn't, to an extent. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying she should be the one challenging any emperors or anything like that. But it does, maybe, given she is the only one that I'm really connecting to, the fact that I'm just kind of reacting along with her does also just alienate me again from all the stuff that's going on. Like, I don't want to get into what the actual final conflict is in this, but there's like a fight at the end of the movie that I just could not have given less of a shit about. I just did not care. And the antagonist, who, because the interest in you antagonist in this one particularly for this purpose, and I thought, like, this was one of the areas where I really felt the runtime. Because when they introduce this character, it's an extended, like, 15 minutes of an introduction where they cut to a different planet, and it's all in black and white for, like, 15 minutes, and it's, like, multiple scenes back-to-back, and I'm like, I get that you want to introduce this guy, but, like, there's a certain point where we're really milking it quite a bit.
It felt to me like this was built as a one of those, like, prestige TV shows, and then this was just that extra episode in the middle to, like, break up the plot, but also introduce a different plot line.
Yeah, but it is clear, by the way, that people are loving these movies. People are I've seen nothing but praise on the internet. And honestly, that comparison you just made makes a lot of sense to me, because this is making me think of Game of Thrones. Not so much that I'd compare this directly to Game of Thrones, but more the way that everyone else is talking about it and how I feel about it reminds me a lot of Game of Thrones.
I can't wait for Doom Part 3, where Paul turns to the camera and says, you know, I never much cared for the Fremen.
I don't get that reference, but I'll just go with it.
Someone there will get it.
Yeah, but I think, some of the pacing felt like a Game of Thrones-y type show to me, and I think one of the problems that I had in that show as well was, obviously, I think there was more, like, I think Jon Snow was, like, the big hero character that everyone cared about watching if I understand my pop culture buzz, but...
Yeah.
You know, but generally speaking, I kind of had a similar thing. And it's not that I need, like, an outright hero. Like, I enjoy many things with, like, anti-heroes or problematic protagonists. That's all fine. But usually, even when I'm watching, like, a Walter White or something like that, like, there's still likability there to a point. There's still something to latch on to, even if they're doing things for the wrong reasons.
I think that's the biggest problem here, is that the stakes and this world that Paul inhabits are so large that by the time that he reaches full peak Messiah mode, he is essentially no longer human. Like, yes, he has human traits and whatnot, but the things that he is able to imagine and process and go through and stuff like that takes him out of the realm of anything that you could even imagine relating to. It's essentially trying to talk to, like, a fourth dimensional being. It's like, what could you possibly have in common? At that point.
Yeah, I think it's like a mixture of, like, maybe concepts from the book. Well, I'm not going to say they're bad in the book, because I have read a few chapters of the book, not enough to really give much of an opinion on it. But the way, you know, books are a different medium, and you can be inside the characters' heads in a very different way than you can in a movie. So a lot of concepts that would still work for me in a book wouldn't in a movie. So I'm not going to, like, say they're a problem in the book itself, but just so much that translating them, I think maybe more care could have been taken to sort of either cut some ideas or make them more of a movie concept and make them work in this very different medium.
I feel like this movie really works for people who have read the books. It feels like it adapts all the things that we need. And as long as you are in the character's headspace, you're saying like, oh, right, this is the part where Paul feels blank. And it's like, cool. But as a movie-going audience who doesn't know that stuff, yes, there is a good amount of stuff that you can infer. There's a good amount of stuff that is shown on camera. It's not an incomprehensible movie, but I do think that major character changes, especially is what you're saying, as we get closer into the third act, in Paul are just beyond anything the movie could show without literally going back to 1984's whisper thing where everyone just says what they're thinking at all times.
Yeah, there's also a couple of really dodgy, like, leaps forward in time, which you get basically from context that there's been a leap forward, but some of them are a little bit awkward. There's one in particular where it felt like they were just starting, like, Zendaya's just starting to train Paul in, I should say Chani, not Zendaya, but but she's just starting to train Paul in the ways of the Sand People, and then it cuts to this attack on, like, a one of the space machines, right, in the desert. And I was like, oh, this is going on concurrently. And then I realized halfway through the scene, oh, no, wait, this is these two characters. This is Paul and Chani. Time's clearly moved forward, and now he's working with them on missions. And that felt like a really awkward cut to me.
It was so much worse for me, because that's literally where I came back from the bathroom. Like, I had no idea what was going on. I just see a spice depot blowing up. I'm like, what? Where? How did we get here?
Yeah, so I had some pause. But another weird problem for me, and I love him. I do love him. But was Christopher Walken distracting to you in the role of the Emperor?
A little, yeah. He didn't, like, I get what they were going for there. I understand that they were going for, like, you know, an older guy. He's not able to fight. He's the old worn-out Emperor. And it makes it easier for Paul to do everything he needs to do. But, like, in the end, it just felt like Christopher Walken just kind of shuffling around set.
Yeah, and it really did, yeah.
Yeah, I think that he plays well when, and I'm blanking on her name, but the princess character who was also introduced.
Oh, Florence Pugh, yeah.
Yes, Florence Pugh. I think along with that, she does a great job, because she has that sort of same vibe going on as Paul.
I won't say what role the other one's playing, but Florence Pugh and Anya Taylor-Joy, like, popped up in this movie out of nowhere, and I was like, whoa, they're in this? They're popping up in everything these days. I got a trailer for Furiosa before this, and I'm like, Anya Taylor-Joy's just everywhere. Yeah. Florence Pugh's obviously everywhere.
The same agent, and they're nailing it.
Yeah. There's a moment with, like, her and Zendaya in the same scene, and I'm like, oh, it's Mary Jane and White Widow in the same scene together. Yep. Would you believe it? Yeah. Anyway, what do I say?
Well, the point I was getting at with that, though, is that I think that Florence Pugh, like, she does a great job with the same sort of, like, menace and secret planning that Paul's character gives off, especially towards the latter half of the film. But I feel like, much like the 84 film, her character is just kind of, like, not given enough to do.
She gets, like, more in this compared to that, but that's not... It's funny, though, I realized who this was from the original movie, because they put her in the same headdress thing. Yeah. And I'm like, Joe, it's funny. Like, they must have described all this in the book and they're just being faithful. But it's funny just how many, like, costume choices are actually pretty close to that movie. You know, the nose things, the breathers they're using, a lot of the things like that, the headdress on the princess. Like, there's a lot of things I'm like, you know, like, I'm recognizing a lot of things from the 84 movie, because they're clearly still going for the same overall idea with how some of it looks.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's interesting.
Should we talk about Austin Butler? Because obviously he's a big ad.
Yeah, I didn't know who that was. When the character popped up, I didn't know who the actor was that was playing him, but I looked it up after. I know who you're talking about. Yeah, he's another villain. He's, almost over-the-top psychotic, I guess I'll
say. I mean, if we're going back to the 84 movie, he's Sting. It's the same character. He's Sting. That's
I didn't even realize that. No, okay,
yeah, that's it. They're literally supposed to be the same person, but like this one is done with so much more intention and so much more drive to it. Also, I'm just going to give Austin Butler props on this. Stellan Skarsgård showed up in Doom Part 1, and he just spoke as Stellan Skarsgård. That's just maybe a bit more extra grumble, but it's his voice. Austin Butler showed up, and he's like, oh, I'm your nephew. And then he did the perfect imitation of Stellan Skarsgård this whole time. It was I am amazed how similar they managed to make them sound.
I didn't notice that. He was speaking with a very similar kind of breathiness, I suppose. We'll see.
Meanwhile, Dave Bautista's like, crap, I was supposed to do that? Ah, I forgot.
I think it's for the best that Bautista just...
an accent.
Yeah, did what he's good at. That's all he needed. As far as, you know, Lea Seydoux pops up as in a sort of small role as well.
One of those things that I felt should have been cut, because it just came out of nowhere. As of now, it went nowhere, and I'm just like, all right, that was meaningless in a lot of ways.
Yeah, plus, like, that would have cut out, like, half of the introduction to Austin Butler's character as well, because that was, like, part of that was making that go on for a long time. Because when you add it all together, there's probably a good 15 to 20 minutes where we just cut away from Arrakis and we're just doing other stuff for a while.
Yeah.
And it felt weird because we hadn't been doing that throughout the entire movie. So all of a sudden,
And also there's this, the whole thing is on the planet that the Barakans come from. I don't know what that, or the Harkonnens, my bad. That they come from.
Harkonia?
Is that...
I'm joking. I don't know what it is.
It probably is, though. but no, it's wherever the Harkonnens come from. And apparently they have a black sun. So a lot of this sequence is done in grayscale, which I don't know about you, but for me, that made it feel like this whole thing was told in flashback. Like, this was not only a cutaway, but also, like, this happened a while ago until I realized how it was actually lining up time here.
I never got that, although I will say this, there's kind of like a Colosseum-style thing in this part of the movie, and I will say that the green screen for this looked really, really dodgy. Whenever we see Austin Butler's character, like, walking around and the crowd's kind of behind him, it really stuck out, and I don't know if it was the black and white making it worse, or if it's just the type of background that it was, which is this crowd in the background, because obviously most of the movie looks very good from an effects point of view, but that one really stuck out to me. It's been a little bit off.
Yeah. No, I could agree with that. I think it's the thing that gets me is that no one's managed to completely solve the problem of we're shooting on a soundstage and there's only so far you can walk. And I think that it's really obvious of, like, you see how the actors in the scene are all composed and they have lines they can't cross. There's a certain, like, we run out of green screen at this point on the stage. And I don't think anyone's really solved that problem yet.
So, I mean, I just want to take, was there anything else I want to talk about before we get into
Score was
spoilers?
Great. It sounded great the whole way through.
Yeah, it's funny because, again, comparing it to the 84 movie, I love the electric guitar that comes in when they're raiding the worms. And I was like, oh, come on, you cowards. You didn't put in the electric guitar. You absolute cowards. Denis, you hack. How dare you continue to make movies in my
planet?
3 out of 10.
How dare you?
But it's going for a more serious thing. I get it, but, you know, it's probably my favorite thing about that original movie is that score that kicks in when the worms...
Yeah,
start being rode around. Anyway, actually, how did you think that looked? Since, I mean, that's not really a spoiler to say there's worm raiding, because that's just a big thing from the...
I think it looked good, but there was always... I don't think there was ever a mid-ground to it. They always had, like, the really far back shots where you get the scale of the worm, and then you have the super close-up with the actors' reactions on the worm. I think that it could have done a little bit more to engage me if there was a middle ground in there where... I really got the sense of, like, this actor doing stuff on the worm. But in the most part, it was just them standing in spot with their hooks in and they're just riding it. So as much as I think the zoomed out shots looked great, it didn't really do much to engage me as, like, a fist pump moment. Because it just, again, it felt like this is somebody who's on a set. They don't have a actual worm here, obviously.
Yes. Nor the original, to be fair. I don't think they had the big worms in that either.
But they had electric guitar.
They did have electric guitar.
That's enough.
It's very important. Yeah, I realize this is probably going to be one of the most negative reviews on YouTube for this movie. Because everyone loves it. Everyone loves it. And I just...
And I don't hate it. I came out of that and I could... This is the thing. This is the reason I'm a mark. Is that I came out of that and then I had to walk across like the parking lot to the grocery store to pick something up before I went home. And I felt myself have like a more purposeful stride. Because I was just like... Yeah, like that's just that level of like it's so like pumping you up, sort of like, yeah, challenge the system, fight the man sort of thing. But like. It's looking back on it, it does play with good themes. I really do think it's like solid the whole way through and it gets me to that emotional point of enjoyment to it. But I think that there are just enough like pacing issues and just enough things that. It doesn't feel like a complete movie in its own right. I would love to see part one, part two together, see how I feel about it overall. But even with what they just presented in this movie, it feels like there is so much that was lumped in here because fans of the book would cry out if it weren't actually included. But it doesn't do much to help this movie.
I think stuff should have been chopped out. And I don't even necessarily mean the scenes or whatever. I mean more... Like, I think there's concepts, like some of this extra stuff with the Bene Gesserit and the, like the, you know, all the stuff to bring up with the prophecy. I think you could have simplified that down. I think you could have cut a character or two here or there. You could have probably, it feels like it is just doing too much. Like you said, they're too, like the book's too precious to them and they don't want to take anything out of it. And I feel like, so if they chose to focus on two or three key things from the book that they really wanted to say, we're going to make the greatest movie we can about this idea from the book, I think it would have worked out much better than trying to fit everything they could in, and to me, feeling like none of it really all clicks together and it gives me an emotionally satisfying story.
I mean, I'll say the craziest thing to me was I was reading through just some Reddit posts about, you know, how it was doing, how people were reacting, and there were people who were really upset with the idea that it moved through Paul's like rise into his position so quickly. They wanted this to have like an extra hour so they could really pace it out, and I'm like, guys, that's not gonna fix the problem here.
I mean, maybe if you were doing like, you know, 10 episode seasons, you could, you know.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I was actually just looking today because we've got Godzilla X Kong coming up fairly soon. I was actually just looking today. How much time would I have to devote to do Monarch, the Apple TV show? Just because, you know, if I have time, I'd love to be able to get the whole universe going into that. And although 10 episodes, 45 minutes, that is a ridiculously long time. But then I think back to Dune, I'm like, they would do great with that. That is exactly what they needed here. I think if they had that kind of time to play with, they could have done every page from this book the same way they wanted to.
I mean, what is 10 45-minute episodes? That's about...
Well, let's see here. Four of them would be... Why am I blanking on this? It's 0.75 of an hour. So you multiply it by 10, that'd be 7.5 hours.
Yeah, two of them is an hour and a half, so four of them would be 3 hours.
Yeah.
So that's 8 hours.
And then
hours,
you add on the extra two.
Yeah. So what I'm getting at is that it's not actually that much longer than the two Dune movies.
No, that's true. That's fair.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They need the full hour.
Like, I honestly, I wish I liked this more. Like, there's parts of the mythology that work for me, but then there's other parts that feel more like they're from old school fantasy. And those parts just do not click for me at all. And it probably doesn't help that Dune was very influential, the book, to a lot of other science fiction writers and filmmakers. Yeah. So even the things in here that I do kind of like, I've seen them used in other ways and other things that I like more. So I'm not saying that this is derivative, because obviously it inspired a lot of those things, but it means it needs, you know, some space. It needs some extra space to work for me, and it's just not quite hitting it.
Yeah, I also think that Paul, while doing some interesting things in terms of manipulation and such like that, is still pretty much your generic chosen one trope.
Yeah, he's just the chosen one. That's all
Yeah,
he really
and
is.
I know that it was written back when it was written. It was of the time there, but like we have already done the full roller coaster of chosen ones of like, we don't do them, we oversaturate, we mix it up, and we change how we do chosen ones, and now we're just kind of done with chosen ones. So for this to come out and just be straight chosen one again, it feels oddly placed. I keep expecting there to be that turn, that pivot, where it's like, actually, no, turns out it's freaking Javier Bardem. He's the chosen one. Screw it. Something else going on.
Yeah, you keep expecting Paul to realize that it's wrong for him to lead these people and give it to either Bardem or maybe Shani or whoever. But, that turn seemingly never comes, unless it comes in a later book. I don't know.
Yeah. I'll even take the idea of like, oh, the chosen one was just the friendship we shared along the way or something like that. Like, I'll take whatever. But like, it's just right now it feels so... I guess the problem is it really got me down in a sense of they're playing Paul up to be just the straight hero here. He is the man who is rescuing the people. And while he does some questionable thing, we are still meant to root for him. I think the problem I have with it is the idea of someone manipulating a mass of people to do their bidding politically is just hitting me a bit too hard. Like, it's too close to home right now for me. And I would like you to maybe back off a little
bit. It's very hard to see a character doing that as the good guy. It doesn't even matter if I agree with what the cause is to an extent. And unless we're dealing with it in a sort of more nuanced way of like, okay, we're accepting that what I'm doing right now is bad, but we believe the destination is worth the crime, as it were.
And maybe we'll get to that in a part three. Maybe that is the sort of thing where we're going to get those realizations. But in this one, it plays it straight. And that's just concerning for me for the book as a whole.
Yeah, yeah. All right, spoilers for Dune Part 2. You've been warned. Like we said, we've not read the book, so we can't spoil anything past this anyway if we wanted to. So.
Yeah, that's the thing. I was watching this movie. It got to the end, and I'm like, okay, that's about where the 84 version ended. It changes a few things to give it a part three, but that's about where it ended. Now I have no idea what's happening.
To me, it feels like the ending pulls from what it knows the second book is and sets it up at the end. That's what it feels like it's done to me. But again, assuming the first movie, the original movie from 84, was just, that was the first book, but obviously heavily condensed.
Yeah, I mean, I know there were some changes, specifically that movie ended with them bringing water back to Dune. The book never had that in there. That was something that has been set up future books. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they talk about it in this movie, of course. Zendaya is like, is it true that water falls from the sky on your planet? And he's like, yeah, sometimes for months at a time. It's rain's great. You know what? People complain about rain, but rain's so much better than desert.
Oh, yeah, I'll agree. Wholesale. I mean, I prefer warm to cold, but I will gladly take wet over dry.
Sure. Well, I mean, I like it to be a nice temperature, but I will take wet over, like, super cold and icy any day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Bit of rain won't cause any harm. Just water.
Nah.
But the bit of the H2O, you know? Anyway, so, I mean, right. I don't know if we're going to go through everything in this movie. I feel like it would be a laughable attempt to even try it.
We're gonna 84 this. We're gonna take the best bits and we're gonna condense them down and we're gonna put some electric guitar over top.
We'll take some key ideas and themes and characters and moments and roll with it, I guess. First thing, it started with like a little quote or whatever before the Warner Brothers logo, which was really
that
weird.
That caught me so off guard. The spice's powers. It's just doing the, like, he who controls the spice controls the universe, but with different words.
Yeah. Well, I'm nice to see the Warner Brothers logos went back to its gold and blue, because it went to silver and blue for a while, and it looked... It was a bit weird.
Yeah. It feels like a knockoff. Feels like the direct-to-video branch.
Yeah. So I appreciate that, at least. So we get... the princess doing her opening, which made me laugh because I remembered like her floating head from the original movie doing the
intro.
As soon
as we saw her talking, I was like, hey, it's you. You're literally wearing the same thing.
We're doing that again. But obviously, this movie is now that Paul and Jessica are with the Fremen, and they're, you know, not trusted at first. As much as Javier Bardem's character Stiligar is kind of starting to believe that he's the chosen one, a lot of the rest of the Fremen think they're spies, think they're here to ruin their lives, whatever it may be. And that's one of those things where I feel like, yeah, that, like, as much as I do think the movie's too long, like you probably could have developed this better, like, and showed more of their minds changing maybe over the right. course of the movie.
It feels like there was like exactly one thing that convinced everybody around, and yeah. it wasn't even like an act. It was just him saying the right words.
Yeah, because they're looking at him funny. Like, Zendaya is like sticking up for him a little bit, and like her friend kind of gives her this look like, oh, you get the eyes for him, do you already? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, I guess she does, because that's what we're doing. We're doing the romance. Yep. But he wants to learn their ways. So, like, Stiligar basically wants him to, like, prove himself by going out into the desert and, like, spending a night and coming back. And there's a lot of dangerous things in the desert, not just the sandworms, but a lot of other things too. So we get a lot of him, like, walking. Like, cause I think they set this up in the last movie, to be fair, but he's doing, like, sort of, like, out-of-pace walking, because, like, constant thumping is what attracts the worms, right? They even have the devices that do that, but the walking can do it as well. So if you're walking in worm territory, you have to, you know, swish to the side. You have to walk at a regular pace. You have to shake it up a little bit. And to be fair, the movie does have a little bit of humor here, where Zendaya is like, you're not even in worm territory yet. Why are you walking like that?
Well, you say a little bit of humor there. I feel like Javier Bardem's character was just the comedic relief this movie.
He does have, like, there's a cut later on where Paul makes a speech saying, I am not the Muad'Dib, right? Stop this. I'm not that. And it just smash cuts to Javier Bardem going, he said he's not the Muad'Dib because the Muad'Dib would always say that because he's too modest. That means he must be the Muad'Dib.
Yeah. They full on Life of Brian it. And I love it. I love that cut so much.
Yeah. Because again, I think one of the things that made me connect to Chani's character a lot, along the fact that she has an interesting perspective because she's one of the Fremen who doesn't believe in all this prophecy stuff. So she's very critical of those from the South who do believe it. She, you know, there's little moments here where she's like trying to teach Paul how to walk in the sand properly. And he sort of jumps in after she's doing it for a little bit and says, well, it's funny you're doing it that way because in all the instructional videos I've watched back at the palace, they say you're meant to, and she just gives him this look. And he's like, just keep going. It's fine. Never mind. Yeah. And he just, like, it's those little moments of, like, she actually lives this life. She's out here. She survived doing this. Maybe listen to the direct advice rather than the instructional video from the overpaid expert that the palace probably employed to teach
you. The anthropologist. Screw him. No, I had so much hope for this in the early half of this movie because it was playing on so many interesting themes here of you've got one group of the Fremen who don't believe in the prophecy, another group who do. You have Paul talking to his mother, basically saying, like, look, the only way we're going to be able to get revenge is to convince all of them that I am the kid of prophecy. But then he immediately turns around and starts doing, like we said, the Life of Brian bit, where he's like, I'm not the Messiah. And everyone's like, you're the Messiah.
This is what gets me, because I also like this, that we've got two factions of the Fremen who one believes in all this stuff and the other doesn't. You've got Paul who considers using it, but clearly doesn't believe it. But I feel like by the time we get to the third act of the movie, it feels like all of it's just true. Like all of the interesting debate of, like, is this true or not? Are we being manipulated? Is almost out the window, because it feels like even if they are manipulating them, it does seem like it's all true because he drank the magic drink and he saw the visions and he's saved the day. So I don't know. Like, that made it all less interesting to me.
I really enjoyed, because very early on in this movie, we get this idea that the Bene Gesserit, they're ingrained in every one of these houses, including the Fremen as well, and their reverend mother is dying. And so Jessica actually has to step up and become the new reverend mother because she's the only one pretty much there who can do it. And they force her to take the waters of life, which is just, as we find out, worm blood or something like that.
I believe one of the others refers to it as worm piss. But that may not be, they may just be joking, but...
Yeah, I mean, we see it being extracted, and it didn't seem like it was piss, but it might be. Regardless, they show her taking that, she takes on the poison, but she manages to survive. And it may have something to do with the fact that she's pregnant at that point, and maybe something else. But I like how that's part of the prophecy. They specifically say, like, the mother of the Messiah will not die when she drinks poison or something like that. And Paul points out, saying, like, no, that's wrong. The Bene Gesserit are able to, like, deal with poison better. They can convert it. It's not a prophecy. It's not a part of it. And I really wish they would have kept that up, of Paul just saying, like, no, this can be explained by these means. This can be explained by that. Whether people more and more can keep on believing in him, I want there to be that sort of belief growing. I just wish that he kept it up. He kept on fighting against it. But at a certain point, like you said, there's this hard pivot where he's just like, screw it, let's roll in with it. I'm going to take this power, because why not?
Yeah. What I found interesting about this concept just felt like it disappeared, like, mm-hmm. halfway through the movie, when he decides to go, you know, drink the drink, almost die. He gets brought back somehow. I don't even understand how he came back, if I'm honest.
It's part of the prophecy. The tears of the desert spring, and that's Chani's special name, is Desert Spring. So when she cries, it brings him back. Prophecy.
Yeah, we also see that when someone dies, because I didn't remember who this was for ages until I realized, oh yeah, it's the Doctor from the new Star Trek show that he killed at the end of the last movie. Turns out that when anyone dies, they drain them of all of their liquid, but they do not use it. They put it into this big pool, which is like their pool of souls. It's like, no, we never use this. We never drink this. We never use it to bathe or anything like that. This is sacred water that comes from our dead. It just stays here in this big pool. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of interesting. And you also see it get destroyed later when the Harkonnens are like blasting this base, this mountain. Fair enough. Obviously, a big part of the movie, once he started to learn to like work with them and he shows off his fighting skills, is that they start disrupting all of the space operations to mess with what the Harkonnens are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So they're attacking the space, like, turbines and mining machinery and all that stuff. And we get a big action scene where they're working together, stabbing people. Actually, that's one of the things I wanted to mention, actually. This movie has a lot of stabbings with suspiciously little or no blood. And it was really sticking out to me the more it went on. Because after a while, it really started to stick out that every time someone... Because, I mean, Fade, the Austin Butler character, he is stabbing people left and right, and there's just not a lick of blood. Except maybe a little bit on the knife. And it really felt like, okay, we're just trying to keep within the PG-13.
Yeah, I guess you're right. To be fair, I didn't notice it. Maybe it's because, like, it wasn't ever something that I expected. But
I watch a lot of horror movies. So
yeah,
really,
fair,
I'm just
fair.
Like, where's the blood, damn it? There should be blood spraying across the screen.
You just hit the brachial artery. If I've seen a movie or two, you got some blood coming.
Like, I'm not saying other movies I've seen are accurate, but there's a middle ground that I feel that this movie wasn't meeting.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I wasn't thinking about it during the movie, but now that you say it, it is very absent. It is, there's a lot of violence. There is a lot of, like, brutal fight scenes, but it is suspiciously lacking on blood.
But yeah, we got this big scene where Chani's got a rocket launcher. She even fires it at a guy who runs towards her at one point from the Harkonnen. Mm-hmm. But this was the scene where it cut from, like, her just teaching him how, like, it was basically their tent that captures moisture, and she showed him how to use it, and it cuts to a scene where this, like, mouse thing in the desert is, like, sniffing this contraption that's sticking out of the sand. And we don't really understand what it is at first. We see later, though, that it's actually because they're hiding in the sand, and this is, like, their breather that's coming up to let them breathe.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the scene where they jump out and they attack the thing, and there's a big action scene with the helicopter type thing and the rocket launcher and all that. And this was the scene where I was like, oh wait, this is them. This is our two main characters who are doing this. Once I noticed their eyes, and because they're wearing like helmets and stuff, obviously, during all this.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Like, I feel like we've skipped ahead to he's already on missions with them. I feel like we hadn't gotten to that point yet. You know, it kind of just felt like a bit of a weird leap to me.
I was thinking of a later scene, actually. I did see this one. This is not where I went to the bathroom. But
I guess what I'm saying is there's an art that seems like some directors just these days don't love a montage. a montage would have done you wonders here, right?
Yeah.
A wee montage.
I get what you're saying. I understand it. I think that it kind of works here because I think the scene immediately before this was basically Paul saying, like, look, you guys want your planet back. I hate the Harkonnens because of what they did to my dad. And I also know the Harkonnens a lot better than you do. So let's do some light terrorism. Let's go for it. Let's do it. And
Is that before this? I thought that was after this scene.
I thought it was before this scene. Maybe
I think it's
not.
After, because it's after this where they sort of say, hey, you're working out with us. Let's give you your name. And they give him the... And I don't even remember this name. Ozul or something like that?
Usul, yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, because we've already got Paul. We've already got Muad'Dib. We need another name.
No, actually, they don't have Muad'Dib. They have... God, what is it called? It's like the German-sounding name. It's like the Kwisatz Haderach or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there's that too. That's
the one they keep on using. They keep on saying that's Messiah. But Muad'Dib just means the little kangaroo mouse. Like that little thing that we saw before, that's just the term for that. And he picks that up at this point as well. In one scene, they give him two separate names.
Yes. So he's amped up with nicknames. I thought that was after this. Maybe I'm misremembering that.
I don't know. Yeah.
But either way, it felt like a bit of a leap to me. It felt like the first time he goes on a mission with them, it felt like you should probably build up to that, have him like sort of propose, hey, we can do this. And then it's a big deal that his plan that he said we should, you know, that he convinced them to do succeeds, right? Mm-hmm. That could be something where that not only is it really proven himself to the rest of the characters, but it feels like, okay, now that you've shown him succeed once, now you can just jump ahead to future missions with no explanation because you've established now that he's going on missions with them, that he's succeeding with them. That buys you that shortcut. I think shortcutting to it the first time felt really weird, like we skipped a beat where he's ready for his first time out in the field kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I definitely felt that as well, because there's the point where they're saying, like, look, the desert's dangerous, you have to go out on this trek or whatever, and that's where he starts getting with Chadi. But yeah, I think as soon as that scene ends, we don't even see him returning. Like, all of a sudden, he's just back, and he's like, yep, you're totally accepted now, but like, you still have to prove you're Fremen worthy. You're a cool dude, but you're not Fremen yet. And that's where we get that whole next sequence like you're talking. Yeah, I definitely felt that gap in there as well.
Yeah. So I'm sure somewhere in the middle here, we'll do it now. Obviously, Batista is getting really upset that all of his space operations are getting ambushed. And then Skarsgård, Harkonnen, he's upset and says, hey, stop embarrassing your family, you little shit. And this is where, you know, after a bit of that, we go to the, I'll call it the interlude of the movie, where we introduce Fade, the younger nephew, who, you know, so it's Batista's little brother, basically.
Yeah, it's set up because the Emperor's daughter is like, oh, we've heard rumors of this Messiah on Arrakis, and what if it's Paul? What if Paul survived? And the Bene Gesserit lady is just like, who cares? It doesn't matter if Paul's alive. We're already setting up a totally different Herzat Quadarak. Turns out it's Fade because we can control him because he's kind of crazy.
Yeah, the princess is like, but isn't he like a complete psychopath? That's irrelevant. We can control him. Like, can you? Okay.
Wink. If there's one thing that's really easy to control, it's crazy people.
Yeah, so that sets up him, because yeah, like you said, by this point in the movie, like the stories of like, hey, this Muad'Dib is doing these operations with the Fremen, and it's like this is, you know, so he's become kind of a, no one knows that it's Paul. Like the outside, I was gonna say the outside world, but you know, all the other planets don't know it's
the
Paul.
The Galactic Federation. Yeah.
So we go to the Harkonnen home planet, and we're introduced to Fade, and I thought it was comically villainous the way he was just slitting the throats of his like servants to test his blade. And like the one last servant's like shaking because she thinks she's going to get killed, and then he's also got like two or three like sort of sexy Harkonnen ladies who are like eating flesh, because there's a reference later. Are they vampires? Yeah. I don't know. Like, there was something going on there.
Listen, this planet is supposed to be comically evil. Nothing they do is good. They have a black sun. That is how evil they are. They can't even have a normal star.
But yeah, so this is all in black and white, and for Fade's birthday, his uncle has set him up a Colosseum battle with some of the people who used to work for the Atreides. They're all drugged except one of them, which they know is, you know, that's not correct. But it seems like Harkonnen has done this intentionally to actually give him a real challenge. Which, to be fair, Fade seems basically turned on that he's having something that resembles a real fight. He can't wait to stab people. He's all about it. But this is a really extended sequence. A lot of this Colosseum stuff over the course of like 5 or so minutes.
Mm-hmm. This sequence more than anything felt to me not only ridiculously expanded past what it needed to be, but also like there was so much more in the books that was actually cut off. Because like we get this whole thing where there's other people in the Colosseum that are working like for Fade, and they've got these huge like black headdresses and stuff on. I felt like there was so much more explained in the books that we're just not getting here, while simultaneously this scene goes on forever.
Yeah, I felt it as well. I feel like just a quick scene showing how dangerous he is would have done, but we get this like, you know, this big Colosseum section, and then even after that, you have him confronting his uncle. Hey, that last guy wasn't drugged. Will you try to kill me, uncle? I should drown you. He's like, hey, maybe I give you Arrakis because your big brother is ballsed it up, and maybe you can have it. And if things go well and we take down the Emperor, I'll let you be Emperor. You can be Emperor after me. How about that? And he's like, all right then. And then we still have the scene after that where the Bene Gesserit lady, played by Lea Seydoux, Lady Margaret
Fenring,
yeah. So she's been sent on like a recon mission to check him out, and kind of basically seduces him, and
she makes him do the box thing that they try on all the Kwisatz Haderach. Yeah.
But she sort of does it by saying, "Can you come into my bedroom? You know, come on," and then does that with him, and then it cuts to her with the Reverend Mother Bene Gesserit. And she's like, yep, he passed the test, and also the bloodline's secure, and she like holds her stomach to imply, yeah, now they're bloodlines and the Bene Gesserit, so we can like lay claim to anything they own down the line, kind of thing. Which, okay, fair enough, I guess. Again, I don't know if this part of the subplot needed to be here, really. I don't feel like it added that whole much.
Yeah, this definitely feels like something that it was specifically built for part three.
Yeah.
It was specifically built of, this will come back in the future. Fade's child with the Bene Gesserit will return in Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, I feel like all of this stuff, all you really needed was show me that Fade is a fighter, which you could have done much quicker than that Colosseum scene, and then the scene where he said, hey, you're going to go fix Arrakis for us. He's, you know, the threat is coming to the planet where all this stuff's happening. Two. That's all you need from all these scenes. But it takes like 15, maybe more minutes than that. I, you know, I wasn't counting, obviously, but it felt like a long time.
I mean, honestly, this goes back to just a larger problem, I think, of he should have been introduced in part one.
Like, probably.
If this movie is going to end the same way, we need to give him more time to be developed. We need to set him up in part one, show that he's a threat there, and then get him larger roles in this movie.
Yeah, maybe introduce some fighting like before like Daddy Harkonnen leaves for the planet. Or not Daddy, Uncle, sorry, he's technically his uncle.
Yeah.
But like maybe show him like maybe show the Harkonnen homeworld in part one and show him do something sort of basically saying goodbye to his family who are all leaving to go do this plan on on Arrakis. Especially since we're in spoilers here, so I can say this. The fact that he's introduced in this movie and then is dead at the end of it feels a little, I don't know, like you just put him in for this purpose and that's it.
Well, that's why I think that that Colosseum sequence was as long as it was. It was the idea of like, look, we need to give him a full character development all in this movie, and he needs to have some weight to him by the time he's killed. I think if you cut down any amount of the Colosseum sequence or him, his bloodline thing, it's just gone. Because what else is there for him to do really in this movie?
I wonder if they were worried that if people had forgotten stuff from the first movie, that if they'd introduced someone like that in part one, but not really done much with them other than introduced them, that by the time they show up again in part two, people would be like, oh, who's this again? Oh, I don't remember this guy.
Yeah, I'd say so, except for the fact that they, with the Fremen characters, I feel like they didn't give that kind of intro to. Like, obviously we get it with Paul and Jessica, but I feel like even Javier Bardem's character, Stilgar, is just kind of like, yeah, you remember Stilgar. He was cool in the last movie. It's like, I barely remember Stilgar because he only showed up for 10 minutes at the end of the last movie.
I feel like you basically, but I feel like they kind of reintroduce him, though, for the purpose of this movie, in the sense that you get the point of his character quite quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if they introduce someone in part one and then they sort of treat his entrance quite big in part two as if, hey, you know, it's like the end of a comic book. when a character returns. Have you ever had that type of comic book where you get to the last page, it's a full page spread, it's clearly a big deal that this character's come back, and you go, who? Right?
Yeah.
I think they're worried of that. They're worried of that type of moment, maybe, and that's why he was introduced and finished in this one.
I mean, I get it, but I just think that if you're not going to make it, because this is a part one and part two, it implies that they're supposed to be together.
True,
if you
true,
make
true.
Like a movie that's just one and then a movie that's just two, you can view them separately. They are complete stories on their own. But I think the first one, we obviously said, did not have a complete story all on its own. So it needs part
that's
two
true.
To exist with it. And as such, it doesn't matter. Like, it shouldn't matter. You should be viewing this as if it is one large continuous story, if that's the case.
No, I can't argue with that. It's true. I'm just theorizing as to why they made this choice structurally, but because you know, I do get the benefit of just as little as you have to remember for the audience who's forgotten a lot of stuff. I get the appeal of trying to mitigate that as much as possible. Because even when it is a new chapter, you should do little things to help reintroduce stuff, and they do kind of do that with some of the plot. They have characters kind of recap a few things here or there.
Right.
You know, that's basically what the princess thing at the start is. It's basically previously on Dune, and she explains what's just happened on Arrakis.
Previously on Dune, sounds of muffled screaming. And next time on Dune.
More sounds of muffled screaming.
I actually do, if you remember back to the 84 version, do you remember that there were multiple characters that were like human calculators? Like their whole thing was that they were like,
do that? Yeah.
That was actually a thing. Like that was cut from this movie. And apparently they filmed full sequences with them. One of them was Tim Blake Nelson was playing one, and they were just completely cut. And again, that was a whole Harkonnen plot of like their human calculator had all these plans and stuff. They wholesale cut out his character. I don't think that it's an issue of you needed to slim down on the number of characters anymore. I think that it is just an issue of he needed prior setup. He needed time to lodge himself into the audience's mind that he wasn't given in this. So by the time that he's dead, you're kind of just like, all right, I guess he's the one who's fighting now. So be it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to remember where we were with Paul at this point in the movie.
hold on. I got the plot synopsis. Usul Mordi, blah, blah, blah. So a thing that's going on here is Jessica, now that she's the Reverend Mother, she's essentially launching the bigger part of the plan to get Paul into Messiah status, is that she's heading to the south side of the planet.
Yeah.
And she's spreading the religion of Paul.
Which looks
she's
all saying, burned. So basically there's like a sort of continuous desert storm around the equator, and when you go south on the planet, you get to this charred side of it, the charred south, which does
and it's
look
completely
different.
Uninhabitable except for everybody here.
Well, the Fremen can inhabit it, but anyone outside can't. I think it's the idea. But so she's trying to just sort of spread the legend and basically use the fear to like sort of like make everyone convinced that they need a messiah and that Paul is that messiah.
Yep. And this is the point where we get reintroduced to the Brolin character.
Oh, yeah. Actually, just before we go to that, we should probably acknowledge that in this, between the first act of the movie and where we are now, interest in Brolin, like, the romance has kind of happened. They've kissed. They've had a moment. There's a quick sex scene at one point. It's not explicit. They're just kind of clearly on top of each other.
That's where I went to the bathroom. I was like, I hope you're going to last a while, Paul. Yeah. I got to go.
And then notably, the big thing that we shouldn't skip over completely is the first sand worm riding scene, you know, where Paul has to prove himself.
That is here.
And they do a whole thing where he puts the pulsar and he gets into a position, and Javier Bardem's like, oh, this is the final test. This is the final thing. Get a big one. And then when they see the cloud of sand kicking up of this thing coming in, they're like, wait, not that big. That was actually also another funny line. He was quite a funny character at times.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, he jumps into the sandworm and he's able to hook on, and it's a whole thing. You don't get a great shot of it, really, but I think it's because they chose to save the big shot of seeing the worm full with them on top of it until the big third act moment where they jump in with three of them at the same time, and it's like, oh, shit. Like,
yeah, it makes... That's the balance of it. It makes that last scene feel so much bigger, but it takes away from this scene. It makes it so this scene is a lot less impactful because of it.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like they're hiding the money shot, as it were. But yeah, so yeah, Brolin, so he's actually with a team of effectively pirates who are just sabotaging, or not even sabotaging, they're smuggling space themselves. So they actually get attacked by the Fremen because it looks like they're just digging for space the same way the Harkonnens do.
Yeah, with the Harkonnens, yeah.
But then Timothy Chalamet is like, oh wait, you're Josh Brolin, I remember you. And he gets everyone to stand down, and then they explain that they're actually smugglers and they're working just sort of in secret. And this is where they get reunited, and Brolin's then like, hey, I know where all the family nukes are buried. Do you want to go and get those?
Well, all right. So this is one bit that I didn't want to skip over here, is that Paul basically says, it's Brolin's name is Gurney. He's like, hey, Gurney, he's family. He's cool. We're great.
I would never have guessed Gurney. If you'd asked me to name that character, I would never have guessed that.
No, that's fair. I would have forgotten too. It's only because I'm looking at it. But he specifically says, Gurney's cool. He's family. And we kind of just get like a short repeat moment of all of the Fremen just being like, oh, an outsider, we don't trust him. And it felt like really unnecessary for me.
No, I agree. Because you have them giving him some looks when he first shows up. And I'd have been fine with that to a point if it was just like, the first time he's sitting with Paul, a couple of them look over. Like maybe just Chani looking over like, wait, is this someone from his past coming to like take him back to his world? Because I can understand that from her perspective at this point, they've fallen in love and he comes from this different world. But what if he goes back to that world and leaves her, right? That's like I could see that concern from her. But we repeat the whole thing where they're walking through the caves or like the crevices and like all the other Fremen are up on the ledges and whatnot, and they're looking down all suspicious. That's exactly what we did at the start of the movie with Paul and Jessica walking through this area.
Yeah.
So we do repeat a few of the same beats again. And I get why they'd still maybe feel that way, but from the perspective of a movie, it just feels like we're doing more of the same.
Yeah, exactly. It just felt like it was padded out for no reason there. And like you're saying, I get it from a character perspective of why they would be a bit more hesitant, but I think from a movie perspective, the smarter idea there would be show them almost immediately accepting Gurney once Paul vouches for them, just to show Paul's
trust. Yeah.
Just like, Muad'Dib says he's cool. He's cool.
Honestly, you could have the moment where he helps him up, they recognize each other, they hug. You could literally have this conversation build up to, like, you know, the conversation that comes later when they're talking, which is, hey, by the way, like, your family's nuke stockpile, like, I know where that is. Mm-hmm. They could have literally got to that same point in their first conversation and just cut to them going for the nukes. They could have cut out like a good 5 or so minutes at stuff here easily without really losing anything that important, because all they really do is sort of show that, you know, Brolin's character is still loyal to Paul. He still wants revenge for all the men that he lost, because, you know, he ran the army for his father, you know, for Atreides. I think you can get that across succinctly, quickly, and move us on to like where he's going to take the character next and what it's going to lead to. But although I do think there is a critique here, which I don't think the movie addresses, is just that immediately Paul's like, yeah, let's go get some nukes. I'm like, I feel like you need to build up to being willing to use that level of weaponry, okay?
I think it's even worse in that regard, because the whole thing that we're stretching out the conversation with Gurney here when they're walking through the crevice is Gurney basically calling Paul out saying like, dude, you're their messiah. Why aren't you playing that card harder? Why aren't you like really resting on that? And Paul goes through his whole thing of like, it's not that simple. I have these visions. I could get a whole lot of people killed. I don't want to do all that. And that's the part that got me, though, is he's having these strong visions that if he accepts the role of messiah, billions of people will die.
Yeah,
that is a recurring vision.
The holy war that it will start, which seemingly the end of the movie, the cliffhanger is, hey, the holy war's starting now.
Yep.
Will kill billions of people, and that's what he's terrified of. Which again begs the question, why does he make the choice to go through with any of this?
Well, no, it begs the question how the next scene is. He's going for the nukes. Like, he just says, like, no, billions of people could die. And he's like, okay, I get it. No, totally. By the way, I have nukes. And he's like, let's check those out.
Oh, yummy radiation. Call me Godzilla and give me a napkin.
Yep. So, yeah, no, I agree. And this is the part where I feel like it really started going down for me in how I understood Paul as a character, because him going for the nukes goes against everything that I thought I understood about the character. Obviously, he wants to win this war. Obviously, there is some level of revenge there. But it always struck me more as a... this isn't about gaining power. And I think that's also why I was so much on Chani's side at this point, is that she specifically was saying, like, look, you can do whatever. Like, whatever happens out there in the battlefield or whatever, I trust you as long as you remain the same person I know you as. But this is the point where she transitions and says, like, no, this isn't about saving our people. This is about you gaining power. This is about you taking back your rightful throne.
She says that a couple times in the movie, that this can't be about you wanting more power. That's not who you are. You need to stay you. And it feels like, and I guess they kind of do what I'm about to say, but I felt like, to me, before it got muddy here, right, where he seems to just start switching what he wants to do almost immediately, is that I thought that Fade was coming to the planet and that Fade was going to escalate things that would motivate a bigger revenge response in him, right? And they kind of do that to an extent, because Fade's the one who's behind them bringing all the ships and, like, bombing the crap out of the initial mountain base that we saw from the Fremen. Although, I thought they kind of neutered this, because when they cut to a shot inside of the place as it's getting blown up, I don't think you see a single person. I thought it was empty. I thought it was just the mountain getting blown up and there was no casualties. But then you cut to the next scene and there's, like, people getting bandaged and, like, I'm like, oh, there was people in there. I feel like, maybe this was a PG-13 thing, but I'm like, you couldn't have shown some people inside looking scared and then cut to the explosion on the outside or something? Like, just to...
No,
You know, I didn't feel the bite from that. And arguably that is the escalation that... But I never got the impression from the way it progresses that this is what motivates Paul to then do his next thing, right? Because even at this point, he doesn't want to go south, because that's the plan, is that we have to go south, but all the other Fremen are, because the Harkonnens won't go there. We'll be safe there. And Paul's
also, the Fremen are calling, like, a council. They're saying, everybody show up, we're going to launch the war.
And and Paul's like, no, I can't go south. If I go south, that's what leads to the Holy War and everyone dies. And Zendaya is actually the one that talks him into it and says, no, you have to go south. And by the end of this conversation, he's like, you know, you're right. We'll go south and I'll do what I have to do. And because one of his dreams, right? Has he already had the dream where he actually saw Anya Taylor-Joy already? Did that already happen at this point? I can't remember.
Did that? No, that's when he drinks the worm piss.
Okay, so, right. But he's heard in his voice in his dreams that he has to go and drink the water of life, right? He has to try the thing that should kill him because it's supposed to kill all men. But he does it
prophecy.
Anyway, right? Because they're riding all the worms together going south, but once they're over the border, he diverts his worm. He goes somewhere else. And he goes to the place that we saw earlier with Jessica, which is where they get the worm piss.
Yep.
Because they've got a baby worm in, like, a pool.
I'll just throw this out to you. Yeah. Did this scene feel, like, so jarredly cut to you?
It did. There was a scene later on. See when Starsguard dies? I felt like they cut away from his death really quickly. Like they didn't get enough coverage of him lying there dying, and it was like such a quick cut after he died. Maybe it's not, but the edit felt a bit weird in that one moment.
Yeah, for me in this scene, there's a woman who is the person who is in charge of the worm piss. She gets it, she knows how to make it, she's in charge of it. And they just show Paul showing up, and the woman just says, like, you shouldn't be here. And he's like, I expect to be welcomed. I'm kind of the Messiah.
And then she teleports to being, like, presenting him with the cup, the holy cup.
She says the words, if you drink this, you will die. And then is right next to him saying, like, okay, drink this. And I'm like, did I blink? What happened?
Yeah. And then he's lying there dead. Zendaya shows up when he's lying there basically dead. And Jessica's like, no, he's not dead. He's like, his vitals are just so low, they're imperceptible, but he's alive.
He's only mostly dead. There's a big difference between mostly dead and completely dead.
And Zendaya, like, takes a little drop of the worm piss and, like, puts it into his lips.
Mixed with her tears. Because part of the goddamn prophecy is that a desert spring's tears will... bring him back to life.
Is this supposed to be the proof to the audience, and I guess also Chani, that this is all real? Is that what this moment is?
So if it's very hard to ignore parallels to actual religions.
Yes.
So obviously in Christianity, you got Jesus. He's a cool dude. He did some cool stuff. But the thing that makes him the Messiah, the guy who is super cool with God is that he does come back from the dead. That's kind of the big thing. That's the proof here.
That makes him super cool. He's also his son. That's not... gloss over that part.
I mean, that's kind of... Yeah, I guess that's a thing. So, yeah.
It's not like it's, God didn't like him until he did something nice. Like, it's his son.
Yeah, no, fair enough. But that was the thing, though. Coming back from the dead was the thing. So, in this movie, that's kind of played the same way, where anybody who had any sorts of doubts up till now are turned. They say, oh, he survived this thing, which we know has a 100% death rate, and it says in the prophecy that the Messiah would do that. So he's clearly the Messiah. I think that that could have been played well. I think that in the movie it was fine, but the reason there's that gap there is because up to this point, it feels like everyone is already convinced. It feels like Chani is the only person who's like, no, you're not the Messiah.
Does it also feel like maybe there should be a moment here where he is kind of like, well, once he wakes up, right, and he's realized this has worked and it's kind of going along with the prophecy, does it not feel like he should have like almost the I am the one kind of moment that he never really has, where he's sort of like,
yeah,
you know, like, I'm imagining Neo in the Matrix when he's like, I'm beginning to believe, right? That's what this is missing. It's missing that I'm beginning to believe moment for him.
I'm going to disagree on that point, because the very next scene, it's a awkward cut, but the very next scene is him talking to his mother, basically saying like, yep, since I drank it, I'm able to see the future so much clearer. I can form this path. I can do this thing. That feels like that moment where he's able to see the code. He's able to ahead and do
it. It's different though, because it's not an emotional beat.
Oh, no.
It's not a moment where he's in awe that he's like, holy shit, I'm actually special and I can pull this off. It's not a moment where you feel something because the character is rushed with emotions. It's very cold. He just, like, it just cuts to a dialogue scene, like you say, of saying, yes, mother, now I have the powers of the Messiah because I drank the piss juice and now I am super being or whatever.
But like, that's what I was saying at the beginning. It feels like we're talking now to a fourth dimensional being, someone who is so outside of our concept of time that it's like there is no emotion left. He's just Dr. Manhattan. That's all it is.
Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying with that. Which makes it very hard to give a shit about him at this point. Like, it's hard to connect to him. And then we have a scene where they go to this council meeting, right? With all the elders, some of the Bene Gesserit are there, and he basically stands up and starts speaking when they're all going on about something. And I was actually asked about this. So one of our audience members, Cindy, asked me a question before I saw the movie, right?
Okay.
And it wasn't so much of a spoiler, but she asked me, was the fact that Arrakis is also called Dune a secret? And I went, well, from the few chapters of the book that I read, the phrase Arrakis, Dune, desert planet, right? That phrase comes up in the book multiple times in the first couple of chapters. So no, in the book, it definitely wasn't a secret.
No, I
don't remember it being a secret in the 84 movie. But I guess technically it might not have been ever said in part one of this. So there's a moment here where he's like, Arrakis has an old name, doesn't it? It has a name before all the outsiders came to it. Dune, and they all go, oh, he said Dune, oh, he's the Messiah, oh. And I'm like, what is this moment?
I love it. I love your recounting of it more than I love the moment itself.
But that's how they gasp, and I'm like, why is this a gasping moment?
All right,
I don't get it. So the
sequence as a whole is basically he's convinced the northern tribes, everyone believes he's the Messiah. He shows up to all these new people of the southern tribes, and they are like religious fundamentalists, so it's a lot harder to convince them. And he shows up and he gets in front and he throws all subtext out the window. He's like, yeah, I'm your god, worship me, bitches. And everyone like raises up, they're all pissed off at him. And that's the point where he goes up, he picks out one member from the audience who looks especially pissed, and he's like, all right, let me prove something to you. And he like talks about this person's grandmother in like super deep detail that no one should be able to know but him. And that's where that like line comes in. It's like, and when she was a child, this planet had a different name. Before it was Arrakis, it was Dune. And that's when everybody like freaks out about it. But I think the freaking out was more about the idea that like, this dude's able to know all of these details and stuff about a history that he should not be able to know about. I think the moment falls, though, because, again, in this moment, I dislike his character. I understand the point that's going on, but like, there is no charm left. There is nothing relating me to Paul. He's just a dick.
Yeah.
This whole sequence.
I wasn't in love with the movie before by any means, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the moment they go south and he decides to go and drink the piss, right? Yep. That's the moment where the movie kind of falls apart for me and it never really recovers. Yes, there's some impressive visuals, of course, when like the Emperor's army shows up and the Harkonnen army's there and they have this big attack with all the sandworms. And I'm like, okay, this is like the ending of the original 84 movie. This is them all coming in and storming the castle, as it were. And I remember the Emperor and his daughter being there, of course, by that point. But so there's a whole thing right before this big attack where he says to Chani, look, no matter what happens, know that I will love you until my last breath. And he's kind of saying it again because he said that way back when they were first professing their love for each other. He kind of said that as well, is that I will always love you. This is important because when they storm the castle and the Emperor's here, and the reason why the Emperor's here, of course, is because he's found out that Paul's alive, and this kind of exposes that he's actually the one behind asking the Harkonnens to go and kill all the Atreides because the Atreides are getting out of line. Of course, it's actually the Bene Gesserit who are manipulating all this. They're the one who told him to do that, which no one ever brings up, really. I really hope they get theirs in part three, if nothing else, because the Reverend Mother needs a good smacking. But yeah. Anyway, so the Emperor's there to oversee things. Stellan Skarsgård's bowing down and being all humble, which is, you know, strange to see him being that way because he's usually such an awful leader to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But when Paul and his, you know, his force come in, right, and everyone's there, and Fade's even there kind of watching all, just kind of like, oh, is this a future opponent of mine? I'm going to eye him up, right? Mm-hmm. But he comes in, and they end up like, okay, we've kind of won the fight now, bring in the prisoners, blah, 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 blah. Stellan Skarsgård got killed. Did Batista get killed in all this? I can't remember. I feel like he was gone by this point.
Okay, so, yeah, what happened was they break into the Emperor's throne room in the middle of...
Josh Brolin killed Batista. That's what it was. Yes.
So he Emperor's chewing out Harkonnen guy because he's like, hey, we still got an Atreides left, man. What the hell? And that's the point where Paul shows up. And I love the sequence. I actually really enjoy it.
Actually, just before you get into this scene, I just want to mention, we did gloss over a scene that was when Batista was still trying to like stop all the ambushes.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where he comes in with all these ships, but they get ambushed in the dust cloud or the sand cloud. And he realizes, oh shit, we're outnumbered and they're kicking our ass. We have to run away. So there's a whole scene where Batista's running back to his ship, even though he's been killing his own men. Like anytime anyone suggests anything to him, he just bashes their head into like the console or snaps their neck. So yeah, these Harkonnens have a bit of an anger problem. They're just killing people left and right around them.
Just a little bit. Just anyway, a tiny roll through fear.
Back to the Emperor stuff though.
So Paul shows up, and I love this sequence genuinely because the Emperor is just basically like, oh my god, it's Muad'Dib, and it's also Paul. They are one and the same. That's incredible. But the only thing Paul does is he walks into the room, he walks up to the Harkonnen, the Baron, just says, hello, uncle, because, or grandfather,
I haven't mentioned this yet. Yeah.
It turns out, when he had his worm piss vision, he discovered his entire bloodline, and it turns out that Jessica is actually the daughter of the Baron.
Yes, Harkonnen. So she's a Harkonnen, which means he's also a Harkonnen, and also he's also Atreides. He's both. Like Paul is a bit of both, as they say. Mm-hmm. The scene I want to get to though is they're in a different room for this bit, but they bring the Emperor and like the princess in and stuff, and we get this scene where he walks up to the Emperor, makes it clear that he's like taken over. And that the Emperor will agree to all this, and that he's going to take his daughter in marriage. And then obviously it cuts to Zendaya's face, and she's like, right? And it's just this, you know, moment. So we get this like tension playing out as Zendaya's watching all this play out and the fight that happens afterwards. And then she storms off at the end because now Paul's still intending to marry. I'm like, Paul, what are you like? If anyone in the audience remotely still liked you, I feel like, just turning your back on the one human character that's in this entire movie is not going to win you any points with me or anyone else. And don't get me wrong, look, being in a love triangle with Zendaya and Florence Pugh, I get the dream, okay? I absolutely understand. Every man wishes he was in that position. Yeah. But it feels like a weird character choice. And I don't quite like, I know they set it up because both Paul kind of hints at it in his plot, and also the princess has it kind of hint at it as well, because the Bene Gesserit tell her earlier on that there's maybe one other way to secure that you'll stay in the emperor family line, and no matter what. And I think that's the Bene Gesserit hinting that, hey, you need to marry Paul. Like, if Paul wins this big thing that's about to happen, you need to make sure you're kind of with him, and that'll keep the line going, as it were. So they kind of set it up. Like, I get thematically that they've set it up. But again, every decision Paul makes in the third act makes no goddamn sense to me.
It makes sense to me. I understand it from the viewpoint of he's basically trying, he's accepted his role as Messiah at this point. He doesn't want to do it, but he understands now that he's taken the worm piss and he's able to see it just all of time, it makes sense. He knows the path forward. Even if it is going to make him out to be a monster, he knows the path he has to take forward in order to accomplish his goals, which is, as far as I'm aware, turning Dune into a paradise. I think that is the final goal for him, is that he's bringing the waters back to Dune. But there's a difference between making the character purposefully antagonistic or making like decisions that you would disagree with, see Walter White and stuff like that, like anti-heroes, and then making them genuinely unlikable.
I think the thing is with characters like Walter White, though, is that even when they make a bad decision, I always understand why they're making the bad decision. And I feel like this character in this movie, I don't think they adequately set up some of these moments where he makes a choice, and I just don't think they've given me enough to understand why he's making this big swing.
I think for an audience perspective, what they expect you to just kind of accept here is, because he can see the future, just know he's making the right choice. Like, you're not told why it's the right choice. You're not given this breakdown. You're just told, trust him. But he knows what he's doing.
Counterpoint, though, that's shit.
But, it is. It is. I agree.
Because if you're just going to tell me the character's going to make choices because he can see it has to happen because he's getting visions of the future, then just saying it's happening because the character saw it happening in the future is not satisfying. That's not a real motivator. That's what I was getting at earlier on when I was saying everything that Paul seems to do in the last half of this movie is motivated by visions of the future and piss drink, right? It's magic potions and it's magic dreams, and that's what motivates all of his decisions. And that's so frustrating because I can't get behind any of them. None of them are motivated by the actions that take place in the movie towards him and that he responds to, and that we can understand that he's upset about this thing, so he reacts badly in this way, or he feels challenged in this way, so he responds accordingly. Like, you can't really follow any of that normal character logic, and because of that, you can't really get invested in the choices he's making. At the very least, we should be seeing these visions, and we should be understanding, like, he should be talking to maybe someone else about them, about the difficult choices that he has to make based on what he thinks he's supposed to do, so that at least we have the context of, like, okay, oh, he's making a sacrifice here to for the greater good, for the future that he thinks he has to try and build. But we don't get enough to really feel the sacrifice that he's making in the scene.
I agree. I think that would work. Another thing that I think is a issue here that they never really deal with, or they never fully explain, is that in the last movie, once he gets the spice, he consistently has these visions of him being friends with that character from Star Trek you were talking about that they killed off last movie. But obviously that didn't happen. He killed him off. He was not friends with him. And it implies that these visions of the future he's getting are possible futures. They are things that could happen on a certain path, but like, they aren't guaranteed. And even at this point, once he drinks the piss, he specifically says, like, I can see all these possible futures, but there's only one that like will work for us. That's the path that we need to take. I think showing the actions that he takes are not guaranteeing this future. They are the best probability, but there is still room for failure here. Show him that he's not all powerful at this point, that there are ways that these plans can go wrong. I don't think we ever get that, though. It feels like every action he's taking is just like, well, yeah, I guess that's what must be for this future to happen. But because we don't know why that is, we just don't care about it, the same way you were saying before.
I think we need some more context, even if it's the context of like understanding more about what he's trying to achieve from one vision of the future versus another, or what he's scared of losing if he doesn't, or whatever it is, right? There just needs to be a little bit more context for it. And even have a character argue, perhaps, that these are possible futures and that maybe he's making decisions based on visions that he shouldn't be, because, you know, make the choices that feel right and see how it plays out. And maybe that could be part of the message of the story. I don't know if it is, ultimately. I don't know if they go into that in part three or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, because, you know, he has that vision of his, like, sister grown up because, you know, the mum's pregnant. We've barely mentioned the fact that the mum's talking to her unborn daughter the whole movie, but she's talking to the fetus. There's this shot of the fetus inside the body, and it's like, okay,
that is the first shot of the movie.
I know.
Is so off-putting.
But, yeah, it's Anya Taylor-Joy we see in this quick future scene. Quick payday for her.
Yep.
She comes in, does one scene, maybe a couple of lines of voiceover, and that's her. She's done.
But she's contractually obligated to show up for the third one now, though.
I'm sure she is.
Yeah.
But I
do want to throw out real quick. Something I liked about the 84 movie is that it gave this idea, because the pregnancy could be viewed as a reference point in time, it gave this much better idea of the fact that these fights, these battles, this taking back by the Fremen people took place over the course of years. As we saw, this child was born and grew up, and it wasn't until the child was like at least 5 years old that we finally got the finale that we saw in this movie. In this one, she began the movie pregnant, she ended the movie pregnant. Everything that happens in less than a year, and that feels really fast to me for everything that's happening.
Yeah, she's showing more by the end, but that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. Yeah, it's really frustrating to me, and I think what's so weird is that I feel like people who love the book and therefore might very well love these movies because they are getting so much out of it because they know all the extra information from the book and they already have these solidified concepts of who all these characters are and why they're doing everything they're doing the entire time. I feel like they're going to like love the movie and probably not agree with some of these criticisms. And you know what, if one person even thinks of saying you should go read the book, I don't care. It's a movie, it should work on its goddamn own. If you can't love, if the adaptation of something can't work without reading the source material, then it's a failure of an adaptation. That's just simply how I feel about it.
So
I don't think this is a bad movie. I didn't think part one was a bad movie. I just, there's so many frustrating elements in both of them. I think they're overlong, I think they're bloated, and I think for all of the technical things that they absolutely do better than the 1984 one, I still had more fun watching that because it was kind of quirky and fun, and it felt like there was some like personality to it. Whereas this movie does feel kind of devoid of personality to a point. It's very clinical to me in some ways.
I think there are certain sequences, as much as we agree that the Harkonnen Coliseum scene is not necessary or is overrun. It definitely has the most like personality, I think, out of a lot of the sequences. It is basically an art piece all on its own. I think that Villeneuve had a vision for this. I think it was realized. I don't think there was anything that was really held back here, but I do think that this feels like it is beholden by the source material. It doesn't feel like it's able to be its own thing because of the source material forcing it to do things, forcing it to keep things in that otherwise should be dropped in any other sort of adaptation.
Yeah, it got me thinking about his entire filmography because I really loved Arrival, right? It's by far my favorite Villeneuve movie. And funnily enough, that movie's kind of about dealing with possible futures in a way. And it's done in a really smart way that feels very inventive, and it's by far, I think, at the biggest heart of any of his movies. And I think one of the things that I felt with a lot of his films that the internet loves Villeneuve, and I have felt very lukewarm to most of the things that he's made, sadly, is that I find them leaving me feeling a bit cold. Like I tend not to maybe connect to his characters quite as much, and you know, it's a shame I feel that way because I want to like his movies. Obviously, he does great visuals. There's a lot of things to praise about how he does things. But it's funny, actually. He did an interview in the last week or two where he talked about how TV has like ruined cinema because everyone's obsessed with having like dialogue and stuff, and like he doesn't remember movies for dialogue. And I'm like, don't get me wrong, I kind of agree with a lot of that. And not the TV ruining cinema part, that's a bit stupid. But I agree with the idea, though, that cinema, film is a visual medium, and the visuals are important. Cinematography is absolutely important. But characters and dialogue are also very important and give a lot of it meaning. And I think you need both for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's lacking in one of those departments in a lot of his movies. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Although I think Arrival was also based in a book, which is maybe why that also benefited from having the source material, funnily enough.
Yeah, but I mean, that could then argue that Dune should be better based off that. I think this is one of those issues of when you're given a blank check, when you're given an infinite runtime, when you're allowed to do whatever it is you want, you're not restricted by what you should get rid of.
Yeah, and for the people who love it, because they just love all of Dune unconditionally, pretty much, like, that's great for them. They're loving how long these are. They're loving savoring every minute. But for someone who needs to be sold on what it is, for someone who needs to be convinced why I should care about Dune, this isn't succeeding in doing that for me. It needs to be tighter. It needs to be focusing like one or two key themes or points that you want to say, this is what the movie version is really about. Is we're really going to tie it down to this idea of manipulating people with a false messiah or possible real one, whatever it may be. You know, maybe focus on that as your key theme and build everything around the characters exploring that theme. And you can still reference a lot of the other things, but maybe not as devote as much time to them. I don't know. I feel like this could be more focused. It feels a little bit meandering to me at times.
I mean, that's what I don't quite understand about that line you were saying in the interview of TV is saying, like, you can make TV however you want to make TV. If you want it to be a visual thing, do that. Come out with that miniseries. Do that.
Well, that's the stupid thing, is that a lot of miniseries and, like, you know, cable shows now do have good cinematography. It's not like in some ways they're better than a lot of the mainstream movies are. Like, you take a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie and compare it to, you know, an episode of Better Call Saul. I guarantee you that Better Call Saul episode is better directed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It all comes down to the creatives involved. And I think he's more so lumping in the idea that TV needs to be regular. It's forced to a schedule. Mm-hmm. It's forced to this idea of you got to hit a deadline and a budget. But that's not a requirement. That's not definitively needed for TV. I would have loved to see these Dune series done in a miniseries format. I would have loved to see them be able to...
I mean, it was once upon a time, but...
Yeah, true, true. But I mean, like, with this style, with the things he's doing, in this sort of grand scope that he's throwing out here, because simultaneously, I feel like this movie was overlong and somehow skipped on the bits it needed to.
Yes. It feels lacking in the development that would have made me care more about it, but felt like it went on forever as well at the same time, which is a really unfortunate like combination when you get both of those feelings at the same time.
Yeah. But again, I was such a mark for it in the theater because the big moments, like that third act, that whole final sequence there, I was in on. I thought it looked great. I thought it was like a super cool moment and stuff like that. But it's when I sit down and I think about, okay, how do I feel about the characters? I realize that the only character that I care about at all is Chani. And thank God it seems like she is going to be involved heavily in part three as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if she's not, like, if they cut her out for any meaningful reason, I don't know who I'm going to latch onto at that point. Anna Taylor-Joy, I guess.
I mean, if she even has a lot to do in part, I don't even know. Like, it's so weird because, like, is the next movie going to be less Chani and more Florence Pugh's character because she's going to be more of a prominent part of the whole thing? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know.
And maybe she'll end up developing a good character out of that, but in this movie, she doesn't get a whole lot to do, right? Mm-hmm. It maybe implies that she's a bit more moral than her father because she, like, you know, wants to talk about the idea that Paul might be alive, and she maybe says, you know, I would say she seems to not want the psychopath Harkonnen to be the new emperor. That's maybe a bad idea. She's, you know, there's at least some logical things coming from her. That said, though, she also is very cold in how she's like, hey, we can solve this. Don't you go in and fight a war, Dad. Let the war rage on, and then you can come in later as the savior of the war, and that'll be what makes you look good. So definitely some cold calculating going on as well, for sure.
She brings up the whole thing of saying, like, no, you don't kill a messiah figure. That's stupid. That only makes it stronger. You gotta just, like, make everybody die and then come in and be a second messiah figure.
Yeah, which, by the way, Paul also wins at the end and makes the emperor kiss his ring. Although, I don't know if the emperor actually ever does it. He kind of kneels down and sort of goes in, but then, like, he kind of backs off.
I feel like it was supposed to be the kiss, because he does extend his lips, but it does look like it misses. It looks like he's just like, yeah, all right, whatever, I did it. Everyone, he's emperor now.
Because all the other houses have sent armies. They're all in the sky, like, in ships. And Paul's like, hey, we'll nuke all of the space farms, so no one will have space anymore. So, which I'm like, okay, that sounds very dictatory, but all right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I really like how they moved all the chess pieces together, because obviously the idea is Paul is supposed to die, or else he can reveal that the emperor is the one who helped kill the Atreides clan. And if that's revealed, all of the other houses will turn on the emperor. However, the other person who knows about it are the Harkonnens. So when the emperor shows up out of the blue, theoretically, because Paul has contacted them, that's the part where the Harkonnens are like, crap, they're here to take Arrakis away from us. Spread the news that the emperor was evil and he killed House Atreides. Yeah. And that's why all the other houses showed up. But the emperor then has no idea of that. So when all the other houses show up, he's just like, look, they're here to save me. You're done, Paul. And he's just like, what do you mean? They're here for you, bro. So I actually like how all the chess pieces move there and keeping, like, knowledge limited, but making it work for the final goal.
Yeah, I've got no complaints about any of that side of things. I just wish I gave a shit about Paul. I wish I gave a shit about what he was doing. The characters are the important part here, right? They should be. And I just can't find myself caring about him. So we get a whole fight scene with him and Faye. Like, Faye steps up as the Emperor's champion. And you're like, oh, Paul's about to get stabbed. He does get stabbed twice, but he still wins. So
yeah, because he's the messiah. He's gotta win.
He's got the wounds. He gets stabbed in the side. Didn't Jesus get speared in the side? Was that not a thing?
See, I was going to go so deep on all the religious parallels, but I held back because I was like, there's too many. Yeah. It's just Christianity. That's all we're doing. That being said, this is one of the few movies I would love to compare in like a video essay or something with Star Wars, because ostensibly it's the same sort of thing going on. You have like a Federation that's doing something bad, and then you have these ragtag group of rebels that are going and fighting against the Federation. And we are supposed to side with the ragtag. However, Star Wars makes them out to be heroes.
Entertaining, charismatic characters.
Exactly.
Yes.
This movie, I really got the much more in-depth vibe that, no, they are committing terrorism. Like, yes. That is what this is. But we are still meant to be on their side the whole way through. So I would love to get that sort of comparison built up as to, like, what makes one okay and the other one not? And strangely enough, I think that it's just kind of setting it in the desert. That's kind of the whole thing here.
I mean, it's a bit more than that, because the whole thing with Star Wars is that it was kind of the reason why the rebels were the heroes is because it was kind of commenting on Vietnam, and America was the villain in Vietnam, and it was the Viet Cong who were just kind of defending their homes, or, you know, so, like, I think there's context for everything. Dune, obviously, the book was before Star Wars, I think. I'm sure it was.
1965, I believe.
Because it's funny, actually, because I think one of the things I talked about when the first movie came out was that it's hard not to think of this as America going to get oil from the Middle East. Like,
exactly.
And obviously, I don't think that was a thing in the early 60s yet. Like,
I mean, America has already toppled many a country by that point.
True. But that's the example I think of, because it's more, you know, in my lifetime.
And then the very final thing that sets up everything else for next part is all the other houses refuse to acknowledge Paul as emperor.
Yeah, Holy War starts because of that.
Yeah, Holy War starts. And then we see Zendaya setting her own thumper, getting a sandworm out of there, and she's super pissed off at everything Paul's done.
She's basically doing that thing at the end of a movie where she rides off in the car with the motorbike crying because of everything that's just happened, but in Dune, it's a giant sandworm that she's riding.
Which I guess that was one thing that There's a few things in this movie that they did that kind of took me out of it a little bit. Mm. And there were two things culture-wise and then one thing involving the sandworms. And that is, they are able to transport their entire, like, colony south on, like, it looked like five sandworms. But you see a whole, like, tent set up and everything on the back of one of these worms. I'm like, everything you showed me about mounting a sandworm says that that should not be possible.
Yeah, they made it feel like, oh, this is a super dangerous thing, and Paul might die trying to do it. But then you've got Jessica in, like, a little tent, like she's on, like, a carriage on top of the worm. Yeah, no, I agree. That stuck out to me as well.
The two other things culture-wise that I feel like weren't proper, like, they just took from the real world and didn't examine how it should be applied in the Dune universe, is we see Paul trying to run, like, a diversionary thing when they're trying to blow up that helicopter. And as he's running, trying to get shelter, the shelter starts moving and he just yells out shit. And I'm like, I don't know why, but that feels really like it shouldn't be present in another galaxy, you know?
But the rest of the English is okay, though.
Like, I'm willing to accept that, but that just feels like, because I think it's just the scene beforehand. He's describing, like, what water is. And he's saying, like, yeah, we had whole seas and we could dive in. And she's like, dive? What's diving? And I'm like, you don't have diving, but you do have the expletive of shit. I don't know. That seems weird to me.
I mean, to be fair, his world does have diving and swimming. It's only hers that doesn't. So maybe the Fremen don't say shit, but he does.
He does?
Yeah.
They don't have shit. The still suit recycles everything.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And then that also leads to the second culture thing, which is during their first kiss, it's just, you know, a normal kiss, and that's fine and whatnot, but they've expressly gone to this point saying, do not waste your water on anything. And meanwhile, they're swapping spit, and I'm like, it seems like their culture would have a different form of affection than kissing.
I mean, it's an even trade of liquids. Yeah.
You get a dry mouth, and Zendaya's like, whoa, hold on now. This is not, I need some more from you here.
I mean, unless it gets really dirty during, like, one of them starts spitting into their one's mouth. It's like, whoa. No, it's not even. Now you're giving me way more water than I'm giving you. That can't be had.
I'm not owing you for this. There's no IOUs here. Those were the things that, for some reason, they just took me out culturally. I felt like they could have done something different, but it's whatever.
Yeah, I mean, those are minor things, but I get it. Yeah. I wish I cared more. I really do. I want to care. I want to like, but I just always feel so detached from what's going on, and I can never really care about what Paul's doing and what his journey is and what his story is. So as much as the world that they've set up is kind of interesting, and I like parts of the you know, I love the fact that, and this was in the classic movie as well, in the book, is that they've got these shields that are both on their bodies and on the ships that will stop quick things, so bullets don't work unless it's a gun specifically designed to slow down at the moment of entry, so it'll go through. And that's why they do a lot of fighting with blades, because you can control how quick or slow you're putting a blade in with your arm. And they sort of use it a little bit in the Colosseum fight, where Fade takes his off to show that he's a big man. But other than that, like, I felt like there was, like, why aren't you using this mechanic more? This is like a whole thing you could build, like, strategy around, that you're not really using. So that was bugging me. I don't know.
Yeah. Also, and this isn't something with these movies, this is only because I watched the 80s movie. Uh-huh. I kept waiting for the Weirding Way weapons.
Oh, okay.
The stuff that's activated by the shouts, because that was a whole big thing there of, like, Muad'Dib was like a word of power, and they fought with their sonic weapons.
That's what makes that 80s movie so wild, though, is that there's, like, all the, I think there's a lot of concepts and words to get to learn in the new version. That 80s movie had more in less time. So the first act of that movie, you're just learning shit constantly. And, like, I feel like you'd have to watch, if you've not read the book, you have to watch like 8 times just to get everything.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It's wild. So, anywho, I think we can rate the movie now. What are you giving Dune Part 2?
Oh, God. So, I guess the question is, did I like it more or less than Part 1? And I think I did enjoy it more than Part One. I do think it is a good movie. I don't think that, like, it's poorly made in any regard. I can see why there is so much enjoyment in it, but I really think that it's kind of, once again, not telling a full story in its own right. It's taking Paul, it's changing him into this more unlikable person, but we don't get the consequences to that. We don't get the examination of that yet. And maybe we get that in part three, but I'm not going to know that for another 3 years. So I don't know.
Maybe more, because Villeneuve said he might want to make something else before he makes it in part three. So it could be 5 years.
Yeah. And in which case, I'll be dead. So
I'll be almost 40. Jesus Christ.
But yeah, no, I don't know. I think this one is better than part one on its own. Mm. I enjoyed the themes more of what they were dealing with. I didn't feel the runtime as much, but that may just be because I was in the theater. I was fully immersed in it. I wasn't able to check my watch. I'm going to go with 7.5, which is the exact same score as the first one, but it's for different reasons. And I would put this above part one, but I think it's giving it an 8 is just a bit too high for me. It's just a little bit outside the realm of what it deserves. So 7.5 is where I'm at.
I think 8 is where you cross the line into great. I mean, it rhymes even. It's easy to remember. Yeah. Yeah, remember Jason Momoa was in the first one? I was thinking that halfway through this. Yeah. I was like, did he die in the first one? I guess he did, because he's not shown up yet.
Yep, he did. I actually had to watch like a 10-minute recap before I went to the theater just to make sure I was all remembering everything.
It was funny because I was thinking, is Momoa going to show back up or did he die? And then like 10 minutes after I thought that, Josh Brolin showed up and I went, oh yeah, he was in the first one. I forgot about him.
I will say, I just did a brief look at like how many Dune books there were. And apparently the most recent one, released in 2007 by Frank Herbert's son, focuses on Jason Momoa's character. And I'm like, well, how the hell does that work out?
I mean, it could just be set before, I guess.
I don't know. I didn't look into how, but...
I think that Herbert did 4 or 5. I don't think he... Like, I think, you know, only the first however many were the original author. But, again, people can correct me the exact number. I don't know how many, but... 6 out of 10 for me. Like, I think six? It's okay. You know, like, I'm very lukewarm. I think the characters and the story lets me down immensely. Obviously, there's great visuals, there's some interesting ideas and themes, but ultimately, by the time I got to that, you know, I was probably trending to like this more than part one, but then once we get to the piss drink and the visions and all the sudden changes in Paul's character, it just kind of, like, it just lost anything it had built for me and just felt murky. So even though there were still some nice visuals and whatnot, I was so detached for that final fight, I just could not have cared less. So it's getting a 6 because obviously it looks great. It's mostly got great effects. It's got the big music. Yeah. It's got all of these things. Like, on a technical level, it's doing a lot. This is a lot like the original Blade Runner for me, funnily enough. Obviously, Villeneuve did the sequel, where there's a lot of technical things to like, but the actual characters and story, despite the fact that I should like them more, it's dull as dishwater. So
that's fair. I feel like this movie is made for people who have been waiting for a proper Dune adaptation. They know the books, they know the characters. This is like really up there for them because they have wanted this for so long.
Yeah, the sad part is, though, is that this is now two movies where I felt pretty similar, meaning that, because after the first one, I'm like, okay, but that was the first one, they've done all the setup now, maybe I'll really like part two. And now that part two has left me feeling the same way, I'm like, well, now there's no reason to be excited for part three. Even if part three is surprising to me and I end up really liking it, it's still like, well, I don't really like the first two that much, though. So even if I like the third one a lot, like, am I going to rewatch the trilogy? Probably not. I'm probably good.
Yeah, that's fair. Though, apparently, there is a HBO Max prequel series coming out by the end
of
the year.
I know. It's about the Bene Gesserit.
See how involved that is in the universe, because I'm sure you'll be watching it, right, Pete?
Yeah, it's not like 3 years ago. Maybe 4 years ago at this point. Will I be watching it? I don't really want to, if I'm honest.
That's fair.
But, I mean, maybe I'll try it just to see. Maybe it'll be better than the movie. I don't know.
Look, I had to do the Continental. I'm not coming back. So, good luck. You've got it.
Oh, dear. All right. That's the show, everyone. Just before David does his homework, we can find out what movie he watched this week. Yeah, patreon.com/MailFuzzTV. You can support all the content, although you're probably mad at us because you probably like Dune and you probably hate us right now. But if you do want to support all the content...
Can we get a snapshot real quick? I mean, not actually, but like, tell me how many subscribers we have right now after we're done recording, and I'm going to watch at, by the end of the week, see where we're at.
Hopefully you can appreciate different opinions. That's all I'm hoping. Go listen to us talk about The Abyss or something. Something where I gush praise just to see me be... I'd be positive about things. I feel like people have this weird opinion where I'm too negative, and I'm like, mm-hmm. I just have standards. That's all this is.
You heard it here first. Dune Part 2 doesn't meet standards.
Doesn't meet my standards.
Anyway, put it on the box.
Yeah, so yeah, Patreon, you can get us reviewing movies from the Criterion Collection once a month on the Criterion Cut, and we have another monthly show called Extra Reels where we review some of the worst movies of all time, but hopefully they're so bad they're amazing. Hopefully. Not always doesn't turn out to be the case, but hopefully. But yeah, check out Patreon, helps keep the lights on, helps keep all the shows coming. And we were supposed to be taking regular breaks on Ace, and it feels like as time goes on, we're just taking those breaks away because we keep having reasons to fill them. So if you really want to reward us for all the extra effort so you never miss a week of the Atomic Cinema Experiment, go and give money on Patreon.
What do you mean us?
Well, me.
I pay money into the Patreon.
You don't have to. No one's making you do that.
I feel bad because I've already dipped down my thing since I began doing these shows. I feel like, well, I'm going to make Pete destitute if I don't continue paying him.
Look, David gets moral support, right? Mm-hmm. And I can keep recording the show. There you go. Yep. It's beautiful. All right.
Every
David...
time we start recording, Pete dangles a dollar in front of my face saying, like, this was yours.
There's so many things about that sentence that's wrong. One, I hate this image you're trying to sell of me. Two, the idea that I went out of my way to go and exchange my currency for a US dollar just to dangle it in front of you is especially hilarious.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Look, I'm from America. Any other form of currency is just wrong. So, yeah. Movie I watched.
Homework.
So, here's the thing.
Yes.
Here's the thing. I ran out of time, not in watching a movie. I did my homework, but I ran out of time of trying to get stuff done before new releases.
Oh.
So I had to do this in order to get stuff done in time.
Okay.
But there is absolutely no relation. I have no way of connecting this whatsoever.
There's no need to relate your homework to the movie that we're doing. It's not a requirement.
Fair. I try. But anyway, Godzilla King of the Monsters.
Hey!
Episode 104, because Godzilla X Kong's coming out, and I just had to put this in here. So, yeah, I had already seen it. I think I already seen it twice before I just watched it again. And I did watch it after I watched Dune. Like, I watched Dune first and then went to that, and I was like, oh, this isn't doing this movie any favors. This is, like, as much as we have problems with Dune, comparing it to then this, I'm like, oh wow, Dune's characters are so well written.
Okay, the human characters, sure, but I don't think anything in Dune Part 2 got me hyped like Godzilla like getting back up after being fed a nuclear bomb. Like, come on now, come on.
The sequence where Godzilla goes thermonuclear and then Rodan's like arrival scene, better than anything in Dune.
Oh yeah,
just hands down. Love both those.
Plus,
sequences.
I love Ghidorah. So him like breaking out of the ice, like, and the little Easter egg of calling him Monster Zero because they didn't know what his name was, but that was what they called him in the American version back in the day. So it's like a little reference.
I think that's the thing I like most about these movies is that they are full of all these like small little references. Like you have the there's this one scientist woman who's
the
hanging
Mothra
around
twins.
Doing whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you cut over to the Mothra thing, and turns out she's a twin. And not only is she a twin, her entire family is twins, going back like four generations. I like those little hints. I like those little nudges.
I don't want people to think I'm overpraising this movie. The human characters, they're like Vera Farmiga's plot is so dumb and convoluted. It's wild. And they somehow make Bradley Whitford be annoying with these one-liners in this. Like, oh my god, Zilla!
I had a real problem with his character even on the first runaround, the first time I watched it, and it has not gotten better with later viewings. But no, I I think that the bonus to this movie is that this was the transition point where they were like, do we have to care about the humans? Like, can we just throw all the toys in the toy box together and make something that people are going to love? And in the end, I think they kind of did. I think that they kind of made it out of this. This is the transition point of, we started off serious of having like real deep themes and stuff with Godzilla 2014. And this is where we make the transition over to, there's a hollow earth and there is monsters underneath. And there's a whole other thing of, we're just getting silly with it. And I think that it works in both of those realms. It is a solidly made, like, just big budget monster film, but it also at least pretends to have like a human plot to care about. Even if it is end up being dumb, it's a good transitionary point, because after this, if I remember Godzilla versus Kong properly, who cares about the humans from this point on? Like, they don't matter at all. But yeah, overall, I did enjoy myself. I did find myself having fun with it. So I'd say it's probably just a nice round 7. It's a good time.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, it's a dumb movie. Like, there's no two ways around that. I don't want to make it sound like I'm overpraising anything. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Yeah, the next one's dumb too.
Yep. Which, again, because I've run out of time, you get no bonus points if you guess next movie's film.
So, all right. Well, there you go. That is the show, everyone. That is the Atomic Cinema Experiment. Thank you very much for joining us. We always appreciate it. Maybe you liked the movie more than we did, and if so, then congratulations. You enjoyed the movie more. Have a nice day. So, thank you very much. We'll see you next time. Keep watching science fiction and computer at Salsa.